I want to welcome everyone to the Jerusalem Salon. This is our fifth event. And I would like to introduce Rabbi David Lapin, who is a world-renowned speaker, rabbi, scholar, and one of my great heroes and teachers. He's an expert in a lot of different fields, and I've been listening to his shiurim for 4 years. I suggest checking them out at rabbilapin.com.
It's on the Facebook event,
and they're wonderful. They've changed my life. They made me think very deeply about my relationship with God and his Torah. Anyhow, the discussion that we're going to have tonight, and it is going to be a discussion, Rabbi Lapin's going to introduce the topic, and then we're going to feel free to have something. It's interesting and thought-provoking, I believe. It's going to be on general topics in the areas of widespread atheism in Europe, negative birth rates, lots of anti-Semitism, and on the flip side, the rise of militant Islam in Europe, moral relativism that's rampant, and this secularist liberalist ethic, which is has claimed the moral high ground but has no response for this failing Western civilization.
Is it going to be depressing?
It's not going to be depressing, because what Rabbi Lapin is talking about is what the Torah response is to this this phenomenon, and what our response should be as Jews in a Jewish country. And so I invite Rabbi Lapin to begin.
Thank you
very much, and good evening. My interest in this occasion is really to meet you, and to hear what's going on in your minds, and what questions you have, and what ideas you have. So that's really my interest. This topic that Sarah sent was very complex, and one could take any phrase in the topic and spend a week of workshops on it. And I'm not an expert in any one of them. And I've looked at the topic. There isn't one word in the topic that I'm an expert in. So we're all kind of in the same boat. I don't know if there are other people that are experts in it, and that's great. And if not, then none of us are experts in it, and we'll muddle along. But there are some ideas that I want us to consider as we go into this, because this idea of secular liberalism taking the moral high ground and what that means, and I see secular liberalism as something exceptionally dangerous. And it's not liberalism, and it's not secularism. It's secular liberalism. Liberalism, which is faith-based, is different, and secularism, which is not liberal, is different. But when the secular and the liberal collide, it creates a very dangerous cocktail of forces that, in my opinion, threaten Israel far more than the Arabs do. I don't think that the 80 or 100 million Arabs that surround Israel are a threat. If they were going to wipe Israel out, that would have happened a long time ago. That's not our problem. Our problem is pressure from the West to become a secular liberal democracy. And if we become a secular liberal democracy, we will have no state of Israel. We will be something else. An interesting country. Maybe even a nice country to live in. I don't know what will be, but it won't be Israel. And to me, that's one of the biggest existential threats that faces Israel today. And many of these secular liberal people are Jewish. It's not easy. So we're dealing with an enemy, so to say. I don't want to call it an enemy, but we're dealing with a conceptual, with an existential enemy that is right within and all around us, and not the Arabs. They actually aren't our problem. If we had the support of the West, and if we had the support of the whole Jewish nation, we would be okay. Now, I'm taking aside God's miraculous hand in all of this, because obviously the only reason we are where we are is because of that miraculous hand. But in terms of the channels that God has used, the group of people that keeps Israel alive is tragically, in a sense, the American Christian right. That's the group of people that makes Israel capable of existing, because they are sufficiently influential in the United States to affect foreign policy. And certainly in the current administration, any support they give to Israel is not because they ideologically identify with Israel. It's because of the Christian right wing, which is very big in the United States. And it shouldn't be. The Jewish people should be what keeps Israel going. But within the Jewish people, there are many people, both within Israel and overseas, that question the legitimacy of Israel's right to exist. So we're questioning that ourselves, and that's very dangerous. When the Jewish people start questioning the right of our country to exist, then we get weakened. But we don't get weakened by Muslim terrorism. We get weakened by our own uncertainty of our own moral compass. When people say, "I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious," what does that mean to you? What is that about? Have you heard that phrase?
Yes.
Okay, what do they mean, or what do you mean if you're one of those people? "I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious." What are they not, and what are they? What do they mean by that?
I'm not responsible.
They don't want to follow the rules.
They
want to reap the benefits of a Jewish country that will help them do what they want to do, but they don't want to have the rules that they have to follow, the Torah guidelines that they give them, meaning keeping Shabbos and things like that, or keeping kosher in the house.
So they want the kind of touchy-feely stuff, but not the rigid rules.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's called Reform Judaism.
It's called Reform Judaism. No, but a lot of Reform Judaism is not spiritual.
That's how it began, though.
I think Christianity started that way, didn't it?
Well, and so did the Protestant version of Christianity.
Correct. So that's part of it. What else is there? What do we mean by, so when we say "I'm not religious," what are they afraid of? You're saying that it's the rules that they don't want to follow, but they're spiritual. So what is that? Let's take it a little bit further. So you've got spiritual, and you've got religious, and I want to introduce a third element. There's religious, there's spiritual, and there's a third element. The third element is Kedusha. And there isn't really a good translation for Kedusha. Probably sanctity would be, holiness isn't right, but I think sanctity probably would be the word that comes closest. So the spirituality, there's religiosity or religiousness, and there's sanctity. What is that? And how does one achieve that? And what do we mean by sanctity? So if you look at the brachot that we make, when we make a bracha, there's a very important Jewish philosophic principle in every bracha that we make, every bracha over a mitzvah. What is that? What is that principle?
Acknowledging God's reign over this earth.
So that's one. That's every bracha. We acknowledge God's reign. So that could be spiritual as well, right? Spiritual people could say, "God's the king of the universe. I accept that. I'm spiritual. I get that."
So accepting the king is different than giving him praise. Accepting that he's the king means the king's word is law. You follow it or you're dead.
Okay, so you say the spiritual people don't accept him as king; they just keep
they're accepting that
as
he
the creator.
Created the
world.
He has a hand in it, but it's more like a mother nature kind of thing.
But not already king, because king implies authority. King implies an authority.
Bring kedusha gashmiut.
Says to bring to elevate gashmiut to a higher level is part of what kedusha is. So look at the bracha and how interesting it is. Asher kedushanu, and then what's next?
The mitzvot.
So what creates Kedusha? Mitzvot. Mitzvot creates Kedusha. When somebody says, "I'm spiritual but I'm not religious," what do they mean? I don't keep mitzvot. Which means I cannot access Kedusha. Would you agree with that?
No.
Why?
There's plenty of people who can access Kedusha without keeping mitzvot.
So you think the bracha is wrong?
What?
The bracha is wrong. The person who composed the bracha made a terrible mistake in saying "Asher kedushanu b'mitzvot tzivanu," because you could get kedusha without the mitzvot. He just made a mistake, and for 4,000 years we've been perpetuating this error, because we know, of course, we know that you can access kedusha without mitzvot. Everybody knows that, except the guy who wrote the brachot that we say. That's a little arrogant, I would say.
Yeah.
And of course, arrogant people say no. They're arrogant. That's part of what arrogance
is.
The
wording of the bracha says we only got the sanctity through the commandment.
So that.
There's plenty of holy people I know who do not keep mitzvot, and some people who keep mitzvot who aren't holy.
Well, let's define. Let's understand that in the Torah, that's not possible. So in the Torah, a definition of holiness is to be able to access God's will and align to it. That's how you align to it. If you're not aligned to God's will, then you can feel holiness. That's why I didn't want to use the
word
holiness.
Actually, you didn't use the word holiness. It's not
holy.
It's sanctity, which is different.
Sanctity. That's why I don't want to use the word holiness.
Setting aside, which is what he said.
So sanctity is when there is no other way to get to access sanctity but to align yourself with Hashem's will, to know what Hashem wants of you, and to align. That doesn't mean you always do everything right, and that's we're human beings. But it means you understand what he wants, and that you're aligned with what he wants. Otherwise, it's not possible to access Kedusha. You can access all sorts of other great feelings. You can get spirituality, and you can get holiness, and you can get all sorts of good feelings, and you can feel uplifted, and you can feel inspired, and you can feel angelic, and you can feel mystical, and you can feel all sorts of good things. But by definition, you can't feel Kedusha unless through the mitzvot. Now, there's a difficulty with that, and we need to take this one step further. The mitzvot, what do we mean by a mitzvah? What does a mitzvah consist of? Just generically, mitzvot, what does it consist of?
An action and an intention.
Which are two totally different things.
An action, so let's unpack. It needs an action. Every mitzvah, there's an action. Every mitzvah, there's an intention. Every mitzvah, there is...
That's every mitzvah with a bracha. There are mitzvot that don't require an action or an intention either.
Yeah, but even so there's an action. Even there, there's an action, even if the action is an intellectual action. An action of an
idea.
Right.
Sorry?
Doesn't have an action.
Yes, actually, it's not a physical action and such, but even that is an action. So you can have an intellectual action. There's something actually to act it out. It's not just a passive state of being. A mitzvah is not passive, so in that sense it's active, but it might be intellectually active, it might not be physically active.
What about lokasim?
Sorry?
What about lokasim? It's also a mitzvah.
That's right.
A great question. So what would your answer to that question? Anybody?
Not
what's the question?
Is a
lotase?
Don't make a bracha on a lotase specifically.
But it's still a mitzvah. So is a lotase an action or is it passive?
Yeah, because it's still a decision.
It's an action.
Yes, it's a choice not to follow your intuition, not to follow your instinct.
But what about if you don't want to kill somebody?
Okay, but let's not get off track. We'll come to the details later.
You know how stress is created. Well, you know how stress is created.
We'll get to that a little later. But just stay with it still. So. A mitzvah, there's action, there's intention, and there's another whole part to a mitzvah which people very seldom talk about. There's learning, there's philosophy. There's a fortune of learning. Go into any Torah library and you will find shelves and shelves on each mitzvah of learning, of philosophy, of technology, of methodology, of history, of Kabbalah, all around each mitzvah.
Well, how does that work into mitoch shelo lishma ba lishma? Because if you do a mitzvah without thinking about it, without learning the reasons behind it, you're still given schar. Not quite as much, but you still get schar.
You're right. We're not analyzing yet what the perfect mitzvah is and what a partial mitzvah. I'm just saying, what is a mitzvah composed of? A mitzvah is composed of the thing you do or don't do, the intention you have, doing it or not doing it, and the learning around it. There's a fortune of learning. So you need to think of a mitzvah as the tip of an iceberg, and you've got everything under the surface that goes into that mitzvah. So that constitutes a mitzvah. When we talk about Asher Kiddushanu b'mitzvotav, you don't get Kedusha just by putting on your tefillin or lighting your Friday night candles or saying Kriyat Shema. That alone doesn't give the full spectrum of Kedusha. You can only access Kedusha when you've got all three pieces of the mitzvah operating together. So you're engaged in the learning of the mitzvah, in the intellect of the mitzvah, you're engaged in the action of the mitzvah, and you're engaged in the intent of the mitzvah. When those three are aligned, then you've got, so to say, the perfect mitzvah. And that's Asher Kiddushanu b'mitzvotav. Now, when a person says, I'm not religious... So what we've got to unpack here too is that when people talk about being religious, there are two parts of it. The one is the rules, so it just means the do's and don'ts. So the religion has become very technical, not just Jewish religion. Religion has become very technical. So sometimes when people say, I'm not religious, they mean I don't identify it with the technology of religion.
Mistake to tikkun olam for religion. A lot of people feel that they're religious because they engage in tikkun olam.
Yeah, but that's not what the bracha says. The bracha says, Asher Kiddushanu. If you might be religious, but Kedusha, Asher Kiddushanu, the way you get to Kedusha is through mitzvot. And mitzvot are not the rules. Mitzvot are all three parts. A mitzvah is the action, the philosophy, and the intention. That's the mitzvah. So if we look at the Torah in that way, that it's not just the do's and don'ts, you're not just talking about a technology, and somebody is saying, I'm not religious, if that means I'm not, it's not just the do's and don'ts of Torah, I understand that. But why would they be saying, but I'm spiritual? What is the peace?
The intention.
They're connecting with the intention, perhaps the philosophy as well.
So what? But what is the part they're objecting to?
I think they're kind of, in a sense, misolati, which basically means that, as far as they're concerned, they want their home life,
the culture,
to be right. It's a culture. It's, as the Fiddler on the Roof taught us, tradition. But tradition is minhagim, which are not the same thing as mitzvot. Mitzvot is the Torah. It's halacha. It's a black and white. It's a set of rules and regulations that you have to follow. And if you don't follow them correctly, you haven't accomplished them. You can have a traditional wedding, you can have a traditional Shabbat and then sit afterwards and play Zmirot with a guitar, but you haven't been Mekayim the Mitzvah of Shabbat.
So what is the piece that they're resisting? And this ties into European Western secularism. What is the piece that they're resisting?
It sort of reminds me of somebody who doesn't try because they're too scared of failure, in the sense that when somebody says I'm religious, there's a sense of responsibility. Somebody says I'm not religious, it means that if they fail, if they transgress, now that they've made the commitment, now that they've taken the responsibility, it means that now there's a precedent, now they're responsible, now they're accountable. Whereas if somebody says I'm just spiritual, then there's no accountability.
Okay, so take that idea a little bit, that idea of accountability, a little bit further, and go to authority. So what we're resisting is authority.
Hashem's judgment.
Right, that's back to that God as King.
It's also this like sense of commitment. This, as like Professor Vijay then puts it, like it's like the sense of being like a boss.
I hear it. What's other?
Of subjugating yourself to God's will.
Yes, absolutely. So being able to put yourself, it's removal of ego. So at the end of the day, I'm spiritual but not religious means I'm full of ego.
No, not entirely. It's also people are afraid of letting go of their individuality.
Is that not ego?
No, yeah, there's a difference, because there's a way of connecting God, as Ralph Soloveitchik himself talks about, in your individualism.
Now, guys, one thing I would like to make a ground rule.
Yes.
I don't need you to teach me about what Rabbi Soloveitchik said. I want to hear what you say. I want to hear what you think. I want to hear what you say. I don't want to hear what you. I don't want to hear you quoting.
Well, in that case,
I don't want to hear you quoting. I want to hear what you think. What do you think?
All right. Well, the problem of saying the problem of being religious, like you said, is very black and white, and the fear is I'm going to have to keep to things that are objective and have no relationship with me.
And that's valid. That's totally valid. If the sense was that halakha was just the action,
yeah,
and didn't involve all the learning and the intention, then there would be no place for individuality,
mm-hmm,
because you would be imposing a uniform set of activities that would squelch the individual. And regrettably, a lot of modern day religion, ours and others, has become that.
Actually, so the spiritual version of religion, I'm sorry for interrupting, the spiritual version of religion is by definition, from back in the day, apikorsis. There was this story they used to tell of Herschel the Apikoros, the guy who kept Shabbos and sang all those mirrors and did the Divrei Torah and had all those great things. And somebody says to him, how is it they call you an Apikoros? He said, because I don't do it because God commanded. I do it for me because I enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a little bit of that. So when I talk about the ego, when you're doing something, when the instigator of the mitzvah is you, you've taken God out of the picture.
Going with what you're saying, though, it's an interesting point, because it reminds me of this like Hasidic story, actually about Baal Shem Tov's story, where this revisited this man, and the man was basically like, he was basically like a typical, like, he was like a literal like Tinok Shenishba. He was basically like, kidnapped at a very young age, and like he didn't remember how to keep Shabbos, so like he would have like this massive party with basically like Ravato, like every Malacha, and like in the beginning of the story, like Hashem takes the Baal Shem Tov to this chair in Gan Eden. And the chair, one chair is for him, one seat's for him, and one seat's for the person he's meet, and that seat for the person he's going to meet is this guy who's like trying his best to give Shabbos, but he doesn't remember any halacha. Whereas later on, he shows him these two seats in Gehenna, and one is for him, and one's for this other guy who's going to meet, and it turns out he meets this guy who's very scrupulous of keeping halacha. And this story ends up being a little less worse nightmare anyways, because this guy basically doesn't leave his house the entire Shabbos, and like whatever, and like he gets upset if his children stuff on the grass, which is like whatever, like, he obviously clearly doesn't understand the concept of secretion for Unichle. But anyways, but I don't know, I feel like there is, like, in some ways, like, going out of that story, there is, like, some value to the intention if you really are trying to do it with Shem Shemaim, but obviously you have to eat a lot.
But then you're talking about ignorance, where somebody doesn't know.
Right, I'm saying in an ignorance case.
Yeah, once you've overcome the ignorance, you kind of spoil that opportunity.
Right. Right.
So now you don't even have that. You don't even have that anymore. And we're talking about people who are not ignorant.
I think that a lot of people, like, have issues because I think that a lot of people make excuses and they're like, "Well, this is who I am," or "This is what I do because this is like," and they make excuses and they don't realize that they can be stronger than they are, and therefore they will succumb to things because they'll just be like, "But that's who I am. Like, I need to do that. You know, I need to be gay. I need to." I need to be an alcoholic.
You're right, but isn't that part of taking the mitzvah out of it? In other words, what I want you to appreciate is that there are people who understand and appreciate chiyuv, but not mitzvah. What is the difference between chiyuv and mitzvah?
What is something you have on yourself, and mitzvah is something that comes from the Torah?
Well, is a mitzvah a chiyuv?
Not
yes, yes. Yeah. But not all chiyuvim are mitzvahs. So chiyuv mitzvahs are a subset of chiyuv. Chiyuv is an obligation. An obligation can be a social obligation. An obligation can be a self-imposed obligation. An obligation can be a legal obligation from the legal system under which you're living. An obligation can be a moral obligation. And an obligation can be a mitzvah. What's unique about a mitzvah is the source of the obligation of a mitzvah is Hashem's will. That's what's unique about the mitzvah. So when an individual says, "I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious," not just from the technical perspective, but I don't want all of that. Here you've got a resistance to a divine authority. So now let's move to Europe, and to the non-Jewish world. So what is secular liberalism about? And when did it start?
The Enlightenment.
Okay. So
the reformation of religions in general. Where people wanted to change what was written, and they said, "Well, we should have the ability to decide on our own what the rules are."
But not even in religion. Where did it start in politics?
The French Revolution.
The French Revolution, and before that in England already. The idea that a king is not divine, that a king does not have divine authority, that's the beginning of it. So who then creates a political leader?
The population.
Democracy creates. We create the leader who then serves us.
Well, not according to Joseph Stalin, but yeah.
Not according to?
Joe Stalin, he said, elections don't elect people, we do.
Not the greatest Democrat of all time.
So if you
look at the political tendency towards democracy, do you see a parallel between that and the religious tendency towards secularism? And what is the parallel? The parallel is, I create chiyuvim, we create the chiyuvim. Not a society without chiyuvim, but society creates its own chiyuvim. It doesn't get chiyuvim from a mitzaveh, from a commander, from a divine source. That's what it doesn't do.
Isn't there a third way of discovering morality within the world so that it is a truth, but you discover it using your reason? Sort of, that's what Avraham did, didn't he? And that's what the Rambam argues. Well, I mean, I can say, okay, from my personal experience, that's what I found.
You can access it. You can access it yourself, but from the time of Sinai, that converts into mitzvah.
Uh-huh.
So in the time of Avraham, it wasn't mitzvah, it was chiyuv.
Okay.
The moment Avraham realizes that this is the truth, that this is the right thing to do, he becomes obligated, but it's not a mitzvah.
Okay.
It only becomes a mitzvah at Sinai. That's what changes at Sinai. Once we come to Sinai, now we can access God through the fulfillment of his mitzvot. But now take a look, take a step back, and what do you think Islam's view is of secular liberal Europe?
No, it can't exist.
What can't exist?
You can't be secular.
Yes.
Well,
their
the
view
Quran
is the
no.
same as ours. On that, their view is the same as ours. The difference is just what they do about it and what we do about it. But if you look at it that way and you realize some of the forces from a religious perspective of what's going on, it's a secularism versus a mitzvah society.
Yeah,
they believe in mitzvahs. They
but the
might
Quran,
have some wonky
the Quran
mitzvahs,
dictates
but they
that you can basically do any other route you want to as long as you martyr yourself at the end.
Yeah.
It does. If you read it in the original Arabic, it does come out that way.
It doesn't matter what the detail of it is.
That's the end lesson
again. But the one thing that is very clear is that there is an authority, that the authority comes from the top, and it is a desire, a belief that secular liberalism is something that has to be eradicated. Why do you think Jews are in the firing line of Islamic aggression? So one is Israel, understand.
There's a pervasive anti-Semitism in the Quran. Anti-Judaism.
Anti-Judaism.
Okay, so there's some of that as well.
They were angry that we didn't adopt their...
There was more than that. They follow Ishmael originally. In the original Quran, you follow Ishmael on his trip. Yeah, and basically, he got wronged by our
brothers. What else is going on?
The enemy.
Yes, as not being loyal to our own
values. Yes. There is a lot of that too. So I'm not talking about the kind of ISIS crazies. I'm talking about a more core group are disappointed in...
Judaism is the only religion that doesn't respect its own religious people.
Are disappointed in Jews who are themselves secular liberals. So that to them is something that they can't even get their head around as to why that would be.
Right? I think they're just being honest, because really a Jew's place is not in this world. It's meant to be, this whole start to the Jewish people is something above nature, something supernatural. So when a Jew tries to be too much a part of this world, they're just being honest. They're saying, no, your country doesn't have a place in this world. And that's right. It's actually accurate. Because we're not meant to be the secular Jew trying to be a part of this world and only a part of this world and not being a part of the upper world, not connecting the upper world.
Correct. So there's a disappointment.
They're not being malicious. I think they're actually...
There's a disappointment in them, and there's a disappointment in the religious Christian world in the United States. So you've got two different groups. The only difference is the Christian groups support us because they believe one day we'll get it right, but they're disappointed. And you've got the Islamic group that is disappointed. So throwing all that out, now I want to hear a little bit more from you as to where you think it's going. Mm. So putting all that out there, so we've got the Jews who aren't really fulfilling their purpose, but we're very passionate about what we do. And you've got two groups of fundamentalists, Christian and Muslim, who are disappointed in us in a lot of ways and admire us. The Christians, one certainly, they admire, but they're also disappointed. And then you've got this group of secular liberals who are trying to remove God out of life. Just morality, yes, spirituality, yes, holiness, yes, whatever you want, but remove God, which means there's no sanctity. There can't be Kedusha without mitzvah, there can't be Kedusha. So you've got a strong group, and if you look at how strong that group is in the United States, what's going on the university campuses, so you've got a lot of... So the force of secular liberalism is becoming very strong. So what would you say? Is the force of secular liberalism becoming stronger or weaker in the world?
Stronger.
The force of Christian fundamentalism becoming
weaker.
Stronger or weaker?
Depends on who wins the next election.
Where? In Europe, weaker?
Politically weaker.
In Europe, weaker? In the United States, probably stronger.
Yeah.
Islamic fundamentalism?
Is getting stronger.
Is getting stronger. So do you see what all these different forces that can't live together?
Mm-hmm.
Those three forces actually can't live together.
Mm-hmm.
And what about Jewish... what about Kedusha? Is Kedusha getting stronger or weaker?
It's too soon to tell.
What is the sense?
It's hard to figure out. Like I said earlier, Jews are the only religion who does not respect the more religious parts of their religion. When you have a Jew who's less religious than someone else, they always see the religious person as, why is he doing so much extra? He doesn't need to do that. With Christians, they always respect those who are more religious than them and wish they could go to church more and be more like them. With Muslims, the same way. The only ones who don't care about is the atheists. But among Jews, that's a problem. The self-hating Jew is a major part of our culture, and it's a bigger problem.
But what would you say? Are we getting better at Kedusha? I'm talking globally.
No.
I'm talking about globally. I'm not talking about in Gula.
No.
I'm talking about globally. Is the Jewish people getting better at living Kedusha and projecting Kedusha?
No.
So if you look at the world, it's quite a mess.
Living it, yes. Projecting it, no.
It's a huge mess.
You're saying secular liberalism is getting stronger. Christian fundamentalism, pretty strong in certain parts of the world. Islamic fundamentalism, getting stronger. Kedusha, getting weaker.
I think it depends on where you are, though. I think there are certain groups within Judaism that are going very, very strong. I think
but
they're
projecting.
Talking globally. There are 15 million Jews.
He mentioned one word. He said projecting. We may be getting better at Kiddusha within ourselves. But projecting it outward is not happening.
Where within ourselves? You're talking about a part of Yerushalayim and B'nai Brak. What part? Where are we getting better?
If you're talking about the three different parts of a mitzvah, then we're not doing it very well.
Guys, let one person talk at a time. Otherwise, we're going to get into a mess here.
So I don't think we have the intention necessarily currently.
Sorry.
We're losing what part of it? The technicalities.
Yeah, but even if you just look at all together, in a sense, it's very beautiful. We're living here in Yerushalayim, and there's a lot going on, and other parts of Israel, there's a lot going on. But there, how many Jews in the world at the moment? 17 million? 16 million? 14
depends
million.
Depends who you count as Jewish.
Yeah, if you look at 14 million, 10 million, however you want to look at it, are we really projecting Kedusha? Is the world looking at us more and more and saying, this nation gets Kedusha?
Not at all.
I would say not at all. We really are failing at that. Mm-hmm. So we might be doing.
Was it better 20 years ago? 30 years ago?
100 years ago? 1,000 years ago?
I don't know that it was better, but the other forces were also not growing.
The Shuvah movement, and I'm not sure.
The Shuvah movement
amongst
was also
the people
popular.
Who were before were officially Jewish. They were actually very light in their.
Depends what area you go to.
Today, they're not. A lot of them are marrying out, and now it's. People who are remaining are becoming a lot more.
Well, that's the secular liberalism he's talking about.
But are the people who are remaining projecting? In other words, is the world looking at us and saying, "What?" When they look at Israel, are they saying startup nation or are they saying Kedusha nation? Really? I've never heard that.
No.
Kilat Shalit. We did Kedusha Hashem when we did. A lot of the people. I think
we do Kiddush Hashem. We do a lot of Kiddush Hashem. We do a lot of Kiddush Hashem. What do you think the reason could be that, despite the fact that Yiddishkeit is growing, in a sense, but our projection of Kedusha is not? What is the reason?
Because we're not connected to the destiny part of what we're doing. We can do a lot of good things and go out and help Tahiti and we'll help all these people where these natural disasters or whatever, but the world senses very innately that if we're not doing something that's reflecting the depth of our connection to the divine through what we're doing, and we're doing it because of that, then it's not really what we're supposed to
do. So when we go and help Tahiti, that's spirituality without terror, really. We're doing it because we're good people. We're doing it as a goodness.
Yes.
We're not doing it as an act of Kedusha, we're doing it as an act of Chesed.
Wow.
And Tikkun Olam, and all that is good, and there's a Kiddush Hashem, and that's great stuff. But you're saying it doesn't project Kedusha. So what are the things that we do, or is the barrier not ours? Is the reason that we're not projecting it because there's an atmosphere in the world that doesn't want to see it, no matter what?
So our leaders aren't projecting that. Our famous people aren't projecting that. It's like you said, there's people doing it, but. People think Jews, they think Steven Spielberg and whoever, I don't know what
Woody
else
Allen.
To say. Woody Allen.
It's more because
Barbara
we're
Bailey,
doing it.
They're not thinking...
And when you think the Shabbos Project nowadays, you look at the Paula Abdul Facebook video where she says she's keeping Shabbat for the first time. And she's apparently Jewish.
She
didn't know before.
I think everybody, a lot of secular people in Israel knew about them. I think that was the projection of Kedusha. There's positive examples.
It's
all
that
good. Great. Like, it's very, like, inward, and when people, like, I feel like the more religious you become, the more, like, people step away from the modern world, and it's like, okay, so the people that are the Jews that are affecting the modern world happen to be affecting the modern world in this technology way, which is why it's a startup nation. The people that are listening to Shirim, the people that are, you know, learning Torah and doing more mitzvahs like that are not going to be the ones that are going to be on media because they're going to be they're going to be like too much of an unknown to do that. And the problem is,
they're
going to
think it's like too intimidating.
That's why they have a kosher phone.
And the chop set.
Exactly.
But whatever. It's just the problem is that they're going to become like. Away from the society, and therefore it's really important to stay into the society, like to stay in the society in a certain way, because like the more you isolate yourself from society, you're going to, they're not going to see you as a Kadosh nation, but they're going to see the ones that are doing the, you know, the Shabbos app, and they're going to see the ones, you know, the ones that are doing all this technology and all these movies and all these, like,
you're right. So what I would like to, I would like you to apply your minds to us. This is a room full of very bright people. If I were to say to you, what can you and I do tomorrow that could increase the projection of Kedusha as we've defined Kedusha outward, it could project. What are some of the things we could do? One thing. So what would I need to do differently? Now, when I talk about projection, I'm not talking about going onto the world stage. I'm not talking about being seen on television. I'm not talking about becoming the president of the world. I'm talking about the fact that, that we project an energy in everything that we do, and that if enough of us were projecting an energy of Kedusha, that would be felt. What would we as individuals need to do to bring Kedusha, as we've defined it, into the world in a way that it can be noticed and sensed?
So
any thoughts? Just in the
meantime? Actually performing sport as you've defined it tonight. Like, I don't know that that's... I think we need to look internally at how we're projecting internally amongst ourselves in terms of how we actually go about performing this work before we worry about what we're projecting to the rest of the world.
So, Greg, you're saying, so if we said Asher Kedushanu b'mitzvotav, that the way we achieve Kedusha is through mitzvot, and we said a mitzvah has three primary components, to what degree are we actually tuned into those three components in the mitzvot that we do as a starting point, and can we get a little better at it, and making sure that we know what the mitzvah is, what we need to do, that we have the right and intention of Kedusha, and that we become more familiar with the body of philosophy and knowledge that underpins each mitzvah. Would be one of the things as individuals and as communities we could start to do to elevate the level of Kedusha, so that religion doesn't become just doing the thing, you know, the checkbox of checking the boxes, but it actually becomes building a force of Kedusha through the mitzvot that we do and the way that we do it. So that would be great. And that's something one could do. That's something each individual could do.
It's one thing to do it internally, but it's another thing that, like, and I really believe that this is something that is, like, lacking in the Jewish people, and that, like, people forget that, like, it's hard to do it in Israel, I think, but in America, like, it is so easy to go into the store and make someone's day. The amount of times that people have been like, wow, you just made my day. Like, and I'll, like, be talking to, like, this person from Barnes & Noble, and I'll be, like, telling them how nice their shirt is, or how much I like, you know, their...
So you say, make people's day. It's not that difficult to make people's day.
And make people's day.
Okay, so we've got two. I want to hear from
somebody. I taught my children something, which we used in the States as well as here, and somebody asked me how I'm doing. I have never, since maybe I'm 16 years old, always respond, Baruch Hashem, and when I'm talking in English, it's thank God, you know, we say this. And I'll tell you, when you go into a public place in the States, like she's saying, and somebody asks you how you're doing today, and you say, thank God, they look at you and say, wait a minute, you're Jewish, and you just said, thank God. That is a nice thing. It's anything that does a Kiddush Hashem, by definition, is what will make it better.
Okay, so we've got three ideas. We've got three ideas. One is, let's get better at the way we relate to mitzvot, the way we define them this evening. Make people's day. Let's do acts of tradition. I want to hear from people who haven't spoken yet. I want to hear from some of the...
I think you need to respect other people, especially if in this world the secularism is rising so rapidly. It's nice to work on your own mitzvot, but that will only do so much for a minority at this point. So to find that relationship and...
And to demonstrate respect for another person.
And I'm not saying you need to make them religious again, or make them religious at all, but just to have relationships and mutual respect. That's important.
Okay, so to be able to develop a sense of respect, so that they feel respected. It's not just that you respect them, but you want them to feel respected by you.
Make them feel part of the Jewish nation in however way they want to do it.
Great, what else? What else can we do?
I'll just jump in here and say, I think that you're sort of making this a bit easy on us, because as somebody who helped author the ethics code in South Africa, I think there's a lot that we can do as Jews to impact the way that the world interprets morality.
That's interesting. Okay, go for it.
And it's necessary to develop that. I think that in Israel, the society is very aware of Or LaGoyim, even if they don't know what it means. Maybe it's necessary to reevaluate that
what is our role as a Jewish nation? Like, on the one hand, we think our role is, you know, to have the least collateral damage when we're defending our people. But that doesn't take into account national defense. So maybe we need to have deep halachic discussion with how to administer a state. And then what is our role as a nation in a Jewish country vis-a-vis the rest of the world?
I think you're saying two or three different things.
Let's
just separate them out. The one is you're saying there should be a voice of halachic morality.
Yes.
What is halachic morality? So that there's a voice that counters secular liberalism morality.
On issues of abortion across America.
On any issue. On any issue. On any moral issue.
Actually,
because it's very easy for the secular liberals to take a position, and that becomes the dominant moral position, and we're quiet. We don't come out. So you're saying, could we become more vociferous about what halachic morality is? Mm-hmm. That not everything that looks moral is moral, and there are criteria. There's a method of thinking on morality, and we have that method, we know how to do it, and why aren't we doing that more? Mm-hmm. That is one thing. And then the other thing you're saying is issues around statehood.
Yes.
And how do you manage a state morally within halakha?
Halakhically
morally, not just liberally morally. Because that's where a lot of the confusion is today. That, yeah, you're right, it sounds no collateral damage, that sounds like a nice moral thing, but is that halakhically correct? And what is the boundary line, and how do you manage
it? When we did it the first time,
it was
the first time we were condemned by the UN.
Okay. Somebody want to say something back there? Just sorry, it's at the back, there was a comment.
I'm sorry. We can speak together. I think it sounds like a wonderful stance we like to do, like to attribute Hashem, as Jews, to present our view of the morality. I know nothing about America because I've never been there, but I know in France this is not possible. Secularism is a religion, a set of beliefs. Why they would like welcome another set of beliefs, where even they're discussing things like Shita is such a against animal rights, cruel, etc. There's not even the dialogue that can be installed there. So I just wonder how.
So that's a great point, and I think what we're looking at here is a way of dialoguing on halakhic morality, not dogmatically. Not this is right because this is the halakha. Mm-hmm. But if this is the halakha, then this is right. Now let's find the language to present it as right. Not just to say, halakha says, the Torah says this, the halakha says that, and that's the end of it. No, if the halakha says A is moral and B is not, then there must be reason for that. There must be a moral framework for that. And we should be able to argue that in an intelligent way that people might not always agree with, but at least they hear there's another way. And I think the point is we're not hearing that voice enough. That's not to come from Europe. It can come from Israel. It can come from Israel. It's about writing. It's about publishing. It's about social media. But also, it doesn't have to come each country in its country. It's just, I think the question is, are we doing enough work in developing a moral philosophy that is halachic and projecting that philosophy in a way that other people can at least hear and say, never thought of it that way.
Because the Mishpat Ivri movement here,
They've done it in law. You're absolutely right. The Mishpat Ivri did it in the legal system to some degree.
So it hasn't been adopted formally, but
it's been a study for many years.
But by the same token, some of the laws are going in the reverse direction here.
Correct. But at least there's a group of people who work on that area as to why this is a better law, why this is a better legal system. But are we doing it enough in the area of morality, or have we kind of just given up morality to the secular left and not developed a Torah morality, which we want to see. Okay, let's take a few questions.
How would you deal then with, let's say, internal moral issues? So, for instance, in the case of Mamzerut, where even Chazal, in many cases, were, you know, people would refuse to hear cases because they were attuned to the moral issue, because apparently the legal halakha was not sufficient to understand the entire, square the moral problem. In other words, you conflate halakha, law, and morality, which
See,
is the...
Yeah, you're raising the kind of the opposite issue, that sometimes halakha isn't that moral.
Right.
That can happen. That sometimes there's a halakhic output, which is incredibly difficult, and we have to deal with, and that's why poskim then try and work, and find ways to work around that, because halakha can sometimes create situations that are, from a human perspective, incredibly tough, and almost cruel. And yes, you can say, but it's halakha. Yeah, it is halakha, but it's also very tragic. And there are reasons why that is. I think you're raising another area. I think what we're talking about is, in the area of morality, is there a Torah approach to what is moral and what isn't?
Right.
And the answer is there is.
Okay.
And is there a way of presenting that approach in a non-dogmatic way, in a way that is rational and that can be argued as to why it is? And that's a great area to be doing, and there isn't enough happening there. That doesn't minimize your point, which is a really problematic area that we also need to be doing.
Right, no, but what I'm saying is that would be the test case. In other words, until you can sort out the internal morality, then it's hard to present a Torah morality that has all of these underlying issues that have not been rounded out. That's what
I'm not sure that that's how. I think there are a whole lot. There's a lot of areas that we can, and we have the tools to be able to deal with it. And still, we have to deal with the internal stuff as well. We do have to deal with that.
Yeah. One of the things I think, which I would actually have expected, maybe you're going to be raising this a little bit later on, is especially for those of us who are involved in the outside world in any way, not even necessarily the non-Jewish, but in touch with people whose religion is this secular liberalism, I find, at least personally, that it has a very strong impact and influence on the way that we begin to evaluate things morally ourselves. So I
mm-hmm.
think it's almost like a bit of an infection,
mm-hmm.
that all of a sudden we find ourselves, the way that we're talking to people who don't see things differently, who don't see things in terms of a mitzvah, a mitzaveh, is, well, I don't believe it. These terms, do I really actually accept them as the foundation of the conversation here? Not necessarily. So why am I using them? You know, why can't I just say, well, I do this because God told me to? Because I'm afraid they'll laugh at me. In other words, I think that before we go into talking about what we're projecting to the outside world, it's important, I think, that we understand, maybe strengthen a Birkaim Koshlot, that we strengthen the hands of the people who are inside here, and who theoretically everything is okay, but they're not necessarily, on all levels, feeling strong enough to be able to project it outwards.
So I think you're right, but what's important in this whole conversation is a missing piece. The missing piece is, I do it because Hashem commanded, that's why it's right. What I'm urging you to do is to get the missing piece. The missing piece is, if Hashem commanded, then it is right. If it's right, I need to find the way to explain to somebody who doesn't even believe in God why it's right. You follow what I'm saying?
Right.
And to myself, I must explain it. It's not enough to say, I do it because God said so. I do it because it's right. It's right because God said so. And I can explain to you why it's right. And that's that learning piece of the mitzvot. When I said there's a whole body of learning, that's that piece. That's the piece that explains why it's right.
I agree.
And we have become so occupied with the action and not with the learning underneath it that it's very difficult. So yes, you either say, I do it because, if you said to one of your secular liberal friends, I do it because God told me to, that's not gonna impress him. If you just say, I do it because it's right, that's awesome. But if you're able to explain and articulate why this is right and that is wrong, the way you got to it was through God and His Torah, but you don't even have to say that part of it. So I do that a lot in my business interactions with people who are Jewish or non-Jewish, but they're certainly not coming from a divine source. They don't. When I'm teaching them an idea, I'm not teaching them, this is what God says is how you're supposed to run your business. I said, this is how you've got to run your business, because this is the best way to run a business. How did I figure out that that's the best way to run a business? I didn't go to business school. I only learned it in Gemara, that it's the best way to run a business. So you take what I'm asking you to do is take God's will, understand why it's true, not that it's true. Accept that it's true and understand why it's true, and teach the why.
You're relating to Tamei HaMitzvot.
Well, it's not just Tamei HaMitzvot. It's not just Tamei HaMitzvot, because we're talking about morality. We're not even talking about mitzvot.
Okay.
We're talking about why this moral principle is wrong and this one is right.
Don't we have hukim for a reason, though?
Okay.
Yeah, but even a chok, I'll come to that in a second, but there were some questions over there. Right.
I was just going to say that it seems a little bit strange to be discussing rights and morality when the whole concept is, in reality, that something is moral because it is halakha, it is not halakha because it is moral.
Uh-huh.
Yet saying something has Torah morality is a redundant statement. There is no morality, there is no right outside of it. And when the outside world introduces ideas of morality and what is right, you end up with someone like Professor Peter Singer, who's a professor of bioethics, who advocates euthanasia and killing retarded children. So I don't know that we ever can convince them that we are right within their worldview, because their worldview of morality and right is completely asinine compared to the Torah worldview, which is the only worldview of morality that we can accept.
Yes, but the Torah worldview is not irrational. So if you can access the deepest rational understanding of the Torah worldview, you should be able to communicate that. Not that you're going to be able to convert this individual, but at least that you can arouse in individuals the thought of, hey, that's another way of looking at it, never thought of it that way. That's all you want to get to. Once you've got there, you've opened gates. And you can't get there by just abandoning and saying, you've got a different worldview from us, so we don't have a conversation point. And you can't get there by saying, God said it's halakha, so that's how it's going to be. So there's that missing piece, that taking God's intention and understanding and then actually analyzing the various different views and being able to explain to another person at least why there's another way of looking at it. That's something we can do in our conversations. That's something we can do internally in our conversations and externally. But I think too often we miss that little piece. It's either I do it because God tells me to, or I do it because it's right and that's secular. No, but the missing piece is it's right because God chose it to be right. So let me understand that piece. And let me teach that piece. And that's a way of teaching Gemara as well. It's every part of Torah study.
Ms. Anana came here very late for the discussion, so I'm way off base, just throw a rotten tomato at me. So one question I have, and I think back when you brought up the idea of Kukim, I think it's relevant in that a lot of things that we do, we don't perceive like a rational reason, or maybe we're told we're not supposed to think that there's a rational reason, a truth, whatever else. And I guess my question is, the way you see it, do you think that we should be able to explain some type of rationale, some type of moral basis for the mitzvot, which are the most difficult to explain, the most difficult to defend, I guess? Or do you think that we should be explaining that there is a certain value in the fact that there are things that we do based on faith, based on belief, that we don't completely understand, that we don't have a rational way of explaining? So I think that's kind of a divide in terms of being able to explain religious belief, or, you know, that we do something because God commanded us. Either that there really is a rational moral basis that can be explained in words to people who don't have the same belief system, or that we have to do it a different way and say that there's a value to having things that we can't really explain, you do completely have faith without a rationality or understandable morality. So,
the only area that we're talking about at the moment, so your question is a big question on its own. The only area we're talking about at the moment is in the moral and ethical area. So in the moral and ethical area, we're saying that secular liberalism has a worldview of what is moral and isn't, and that has become the accepted viewpoint, and the response to that has been, well, we don't believe that, we've got different beliefs. And what I'm suggesting is, no, we need to get involved in that in that conversation. Because in the area of morality, we can explain reasons why Hashem wants us to do the one. Your question and your comment is valid for all the other mitzvot, but right now we're just talking about the conversation about morality and ethics. That there is a Torah morality doesn't mean that there's just one right and wrong. There's a spectrum, but there's certainly stuff that's outside of that spectrum, and we can explain why that is the correct way and why that is the Torah way, and that conversation should be going on. I want to draw it to an end quite soon, so I'll just do a few comments.
What about people who feel like they're religious, but they really just view things with the same secular Western like cultural views, but they say okay, fine, we'll fit the Torah into that. Like maybe for example, some people in like more like open Orthodox groups in America, or like here, like the Shir Chalashah type groups, you know, like how do we deal with those kind of people? Because they still feel like they're halakhic, and maybe they are technically keeping halakha, but they're not going with that Mesorah. So how do we deal with them?
So great point. That comes back to a little bit to this point of the fact that we're importing a lot of that thinking into our own. And what you're dealing with there is people who are keeping the action piece of halakha, but aren't well steeped in the learning piece. So that learning piece they're bringing in from outside because they're not well steeped in our own learning. So so one of our big flaws there is ignorance of depth. Not just ignorance of the detail of how do you keep Shabbat and what are you allowed to do and not allowed to do, but ignorance of the depth that lies underneath that and the learning that lies underneath that. So we do have a massive problem there of the infiltration of secular liberalism right into orthodoxy. Yeah, the way we learn Chumash, the way we learn Tanakh, the way we learn Gemara, a lot of that has become influenced by Western methodology.
And right, and there's some ways where it's inappropriate. I'm saying like there are some, there are clearly like Rishonim and others that like did that and did it in an appropriate way, but like how do you balance that out also, I guess.
Okay, so that's a great point. You wanted to say something and then I want to take that point and then I'll close it.
I was just going to say, you know, your question is like, well, what do you do with that? And so like, there's a lot of people speaking and there's a lot of people into all this global blah blah blah, and I'm just one person living in Israel. And so what I do is I live my Jewish life. And I have a job and I work for a very big, big company. I spend the whole day on Link looking at and talking to people all over the world, many of them here. Those that are in Israel, they know I'm religious because I wear shekel to work. They don't realize it's not my hair. So they're not religious people, but I am. Without saying so, they know that. So it's interesting that when the guys are around, they don't use profanity when I'm around, and when they have to pick a movie to go for the group to go to, they have a real problem finding a movie that I'm willing to go to. Blah, blah, blah. Now, it's all really funny, but you know what? I mind my own business, and I do my job in my cube, and every time anyone has, you wouldn't believe the people that come up to me with these incredibly weird problems, like, how am I supposed to, but I'm the one they come to, and I have no sign, and I do that over the internet. Now, I'm not saying any of these people I'm talking to in China and Shanghai and da-da-da know that I'm religious. Or do they know that I'm Jewish? And maybe they do because I'm in Israel, and they probably know that because it's on my letterhead. I behave a certain way, and I act a certain way, and I speak a certain way, and so even some of these people, because I'm on the internet at night too because of the time zone stuff, and it's amazing to me sometimes the conversations that come up, like I'm like, let's keep this professional, but they have all these questions, and I'm like, why am I attracting them? You know, because I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and
you're putting out an energy.
That's right. And you know what? I'm not trying to convert anybody, but let these people that, and if one day they meet someone that's Jewish, like, oh well, you know, I know someone else that was at that, and then they've got a positive something with that.
Let's take that last break.
It's a question. I'm curious. In the age of the smartphone, to what extent are people actually receptive to death and to a lack of ego? We're meant to be reflecting these values, reflecting humility and the depth of the mitzvah, but people are increasingly becoming under the impression that the world can be captured in a tweet or a Facebook status or anything that can fit on their screen. So to what extent is our market, so to speak, actually even interested or receptive?
So I can only speak, and it's an important observation, I can only speak from my experience in the United States, so with the corporations with which I work and teach them these things. And that was a big question when I started doing it too. Are they going to just reject it because it's just too far out of their world? Or are they going to be so thirsty for it that they're going to grab onto it with thirst? And it's the second.
Mm-hmm.
People are becoming more and more desperate for depth, more and more desperate for connection, more and more desperate for authenticity, and they will respond to it, like this example here that we had here of across the world, somebody just picking up, but this person's a little different, and not even know why.
I think that's fascinating because it's almost like it reinforces emunah, of my own emunah in a way, because it suggests that no matter what's happening on the surface to people, if there's always that yearning, where's it coming from?
The opportunity is greater than it's ever been before, and as technology takes over more and more, and you have it, if you look at it at a very simple business level, I argue those businesses or those individuals in businesses that use human interaction have a huge advantage because there's so little of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if instead of doing a video conference you get into a plane and go and meet somebody, that's a huge advantage if you're trying to sell something or to create a connection with somebody, because it doesn't happen that often. If you write a personal letter to somebody instead of an email, they don't get letters anymore. They get so excited now when they get a letter that's actually handwritten. And so people are very open now. There's an opportunity to creep in there and give people what they're not getting anywhere else, which is just real authentic human contact and caring and a connection with Kedusha. If you're living your life in some way, in your own way, you're being mekayem that asher kedushanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu, and you're able to project that just in who you are, not in what you're doing, or just in who you are. People pick that up, and they connect with that, and they gravitate to it because it's so unusual. And that way, we could be projecting far more kedusha than we are. Not just to give up to technology, but to realize there's actually an opportunity here because people are so starved. So thank you very much. I hope at least we got some thinking going and some conversation going, which you'll take further in other forums.
Thank you.
Please like our Facebook page.